hello, and welcome to The Wire, where we have independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station right around Australia. I'm Max Tillman in Sydney, and coming up on today's show...
That's a good question, because it's clearer than ever that Australia's diplomatic position on climate is very isolated.
Think tank the Australia Institute is calling on the New South Wales government to support a national climate compensation fund funded by a levy on fossil fuel exports. But would a state-level carbon tax work any better than it did on the federal stage? Also on the program...
Really, there's not that much good news in terms of Australia and climate change in terms of impacts and adaptation to those impacts.
Food shortages, extreme weather events and a potential mental health crisis are only a few of the risks of a 3-degree increase in global average temperatures, according to a new report by the Australian Academy. Stay tuned for all this and more coming up on The Wire. But first... The COVID-19 vaccine rollout for the Yurrayungi Aboriginal Medical Service is in trouble after it was revealed by their CEO, Brenda Garston, that the clinic was currently delivering only 5 vaccine shots a day. The Yurrayungi Medical Service is the only location providing vaccines for Halls Creek in the Northern Territory, even though the town recorded their first COVID-19 case just a week ago. Andrew Herlinger has the story.
As the federal government continues its struggle to vaccinate the nation, there are growing fears from an Aboriginal medical centre in the Kimberley that they will be unable to convince people to take the COVID-19 vaccine. The concern comes after it was announced by the government that the AstraZeneca vaccine would only be available for Australians over 50, after Health Advice warned of a potential link between rare blood clots and the vaccine. Yurrayungi Aboriginal Medical Service is the only centre providing the vaccine, and their CEO, Brenda Garstone, has declared that citizens in her community were now too scared to take the vaccine.
Up until the announcement of the shift in utilising the AstraZeneca vaccine to only 50-year-olds and upwards, we were averaging around 10 a day. Now we've gone back to roughly about 5 a day.
Yurrayungi Aboriginal Medical Service operates in the town of Halls Creek, which has a population of around 2,000 to 3,000. As a result, one of their main priorities has been to go around and educate people of the importance of taking the vaccine, a challenge which is made even harder by the new health advice.
So because... everyone knows that our people are the most vulnerable here in Australia. We are working with our most vulnerable on a day-to-day basis, speaking to them one-on-one, going out on home visits and speaking to them in their own space. Like I said, there's a big shift because of this now confirmed concern of the clotting link to the AstraZeneca vaccine. Our people are now refusing to have the vaccine.
Following the AstraZeneca shakeup, there has been a bigger importance placed on obtaining the Pfizer vaccine, with Prime Minister Scott Morrison declaring that Australia had secured an extra 20 million doses. One of the challenges, though, with the Pfizer vaccine is that it needs to remain refrigerated for it to remain effective. When asked about the potential of receiving the Pfizer, CEO Brenda Garstone has claimed that there is no way that her health service has the ability to administer this vaccine.
Well, obviously, we do need an alternative. I mean, and we're, you know, everyone follows the news of the day and the advice from the experts, scientific expertise. So right now, they're actually saying that it's only the over 50-year-olds that should be taking the AstraZeneca vaccine. And the under 50-year-olds need to now switch to taking up the Pfizer. Well, of course, we don't have the Pfizer vaccine. And so we do need to do a lot more work around convincing our mob that, you know, any vaccine is safe.
CEO Brenda Garstone also admitted that she has no knowledge of when the Pfizer will arrive and that her priority is to increase the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine.
That is another issue for us because we don't have the infrastructure to accommodate this new vaccine of the Pfizer. So therefore, again, we need to be resourced. And at the moment, there's still no conversation with us around, you know, providing that extra investment into our organisation to upgrade our infrastructure to be able to accommodate this new vaccine.
This new challenge to communicate the safety and importance of the COVID vaccine comes amid news that the town of Hall Creek had recorded its first COVID-19 case, which in turn resulted in hospital staff being placed in isolation and the closure of Yurrayunga. Consequently, Brenda Garstone believes that the additional government support is needed.
And then certainly, you know, we have been raising the issue to our people around what's happening in Papua New Guinea, and it is a big concern. So, but at the moment, because of our remoteness, it feels like we're kind of in a little bubble. However, we do certainly understand that once the borders open up, that we are going to be put up as high risk of contracting the COVID-19. And that's where we do need to ramp up our work in the community around educating our members the importance of having the vaccine. But again, it's a drain, added layer of another drain on our resources, because at the moment we are not funded to do, you know, to be getting out there doing public health. I know we are well placed to do that because we know how to communicate with our people, but the government needs to understand that they do need to give us more funding so we can employ more people and have more hands and legs on the ground going out and speaking to our people and communicating and giving them an opportunity to debrief how they're feeling and to ask questions in a safer environment so that they can feel that they're very much well informed, because if they're not feeling that they're being well informed, our people will refuse to take the vaccine.
Brenda Garstone is not alone in her fears over the community rejecting the vaccine. Even Kate Clark, the communications manager at Purple House, an Indigenous-owned health centre operating in Alice Springs, is worried.
Look, most of the people who we know who've had the vaccine, either because they're part of our staff who are frontline workers or our patients who've received it because they're in high-risk categories, those who've had it generally feel really confident and feel like it was a good thing for them, and they feel, you know, they feel safer now that they've got that vaccine. But as I said before, certainly we do also have a number of our patients and their families who still feel a high level of anxiety and uncertainty about whether it's safe for them to get the vaccine or not, and obviously that is of concern.
Overall, though, Brenda Garstone believes that the biggest challenge to the vaccine rollout is distributing it to these remote areas with limited resources. She even gave us an example into how much funding she believes her centre needs.
If I think about FTEs, so we would need, I don't know, off the top of my head, it might seem extravagant, but around 500,000.
Brenda Garstone again.
At the moment, clinically, we've got around 5 Aboriginal health workers. We've got 3 nurses divided up from clinical to child health to chronic disease health with the registered nurses. And then we've got 2 GPs. One is a permanent position, the other is a locum. So we're a revolving door with locums because of our remoteness and our difficulty with attracting and retaining professional staff.
That was Brenda Garston, the CEO of Halls Creek Aboriginal Medical Service in the Northern Territory, ending that report by Andrew Herlinger.
Reception isn't always the best out here in the bush. But if I miss The Wire, I listen to the podcast.
The Wire. Across Australia, weeknights on Indigenous and Community Radio, and now podcast.
Today, the New South Wales Treasury's intergenerational report on climate risk showed that the average annual costs of climate change for the state of New South Wales are set to increase by an overwhelming $10 billion a year over the coming decades, with costs capable of reaching as much as $75 billion annually. Nathan Nikolic spoke with Mark Ogue, Principal Advisor of the Australia Institute and former New South Wales Premier, the Honourable Bob Carr, to discuss state-level carbon tax concerns.
Well, Climate change has, there's huge impacts of climate change, and with those huge impacts, there's enormous costs. So the frequency and intensity of fires and flood and heat waves and coastal erosions and all of these kinds of impacts of climate change are increasing, and they have huge costs in terms of emergency response and recovery and all just the disruptions to people's lives. Now, at the moment, that's being entirely paid for by ordinary people in New South Wales and around Australia, either through sort of the direct impacts like losing your property or disruption to your life, or through higher taxes and rates and insurance premiums, that kind of thing. And that's not fair. Ordinary people shouldn't have to pay when the problem's actually being caused by enormous global coal and gas companies. And you know, they're the ones putting the emissions into the air and causing the problem, and so they should be contributing to the costs. And that's why we've proposed a national climate compensation fund funded by a levy on fossil fuel exports from Australia.
Professor Carr speaking.
That's a good question, because it's clearer than ever that Australia's diplomatic position on climate is very isolated. We've got a number of climate summits coming up, April 22nd. We're there with 40 other countries, probably held on a virtual basis, certainly as far as Australian participation is concerned, convened by US President Joseph R. Biden. And I would expect that America will use that summit to increase its commitment to reducing emissions by 2030, its medium-term goal. Boris Johnson's government in the UK has already done that. And Australia will be going to this summit basically saying, we're still reviewing our position, but without any big announcement about increased ambitions for 2030 in terms of reduced emissions. Yet the whole spirit of the Paris Agreement of 2015 is that nations will increase their nationally determined contribution to the climate challenge. And we've really got nothing to say, and I think that leaves us exposed. We're stuck saying we won't commit to net zero emissions in 2050, but we'd sort of like to get there. That's Scott Morrison's position. Now, I think he's going to have to do a whole lot better than that. So we are going to be under pressure not only at this month's summit, but at the G7, which Britain is hosting, and which will devote a lot of its time to climate, because Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, is hosting the Glasgow summit at the end of the year devoted to climate, and he wants it to be a thumping success for Britain's diplomacy and for Britain's role in the world post-Brexit. And he would be hoping, as he made clear when he refused to give us a speaking role at a summit he was hosting in December, that he regards Australia's commitment as pretty modest.
Now, Mark, what are the future cost projections if New South Wales government policy remains the same?
Well, at the moment, the New South Wales Treasury has projected that over the next 40 years, so well within the lifetime of many of your listeners, the cost of climate change will rise from about $5 billion on average a year in New South Wales. The cost of natural disasters will rise from about $5 billion a year in New South Wales to over $15 billion if emissions keep increasing. And even more frightening, they're saying that that's the average annual cost. But what they're also saying is that in any given year, the cost could be up to $75 billion, which is just an absolutely massive cost that at the moment will just be lumped onto ordinary New South Wales households and businesses.
If the annual climate change bill is passed, where will the funds be distributed?
There's so many priorities we'd have to be very, you know, you'd have to prioritise. But some of the things that could be done with the money include additional emergency responders, like for in fire or flood emergency responders, that kind of thing. Reconstruction of public infrastructure. It could go to assisting individuals who, through no fault of their own, have had their property damaged or lost. It could go to local councils who are at the coalface of dealing with, or the front line, I should say, of dealing with the impacts of climate change and who are not very well resourced. It could also go to industries that are being hit, particularly farmers who are particularly impacted by climate-related disasters, but also industries like the tourism industry.
That's the biggest challenge that faces us. We're not pricing carbon. We dumped the emissions trading scheme that the Gillard government had, and which, going back further in time, even John Howard supported before 2007, defeated in the Senate in late 2009 when Tony Abbott took over the leadership of the Conservative Party. We haven't got an emissions trading scheme, but the world could be moving to hold us accountable and saying, well, if you're not pricing carbon through emissions trading or a carbon tax, you're going to face a carbon tariff that we'll impose before you can export goods into our market.
Former New South Wales Premier Bob Carr speaking there with Nathan Nikolic.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio right across Australia. Stay well.
Well, more extreme weather events, a potential mental health crisis, and pressure on Australia's food security are just a few of the risks that are spelt out in the Australian Academy's new report on the risks of a 3-degree warmer planet. Reporter Evan Wallace spoke with the report's lead author, Mark Howen, and leading environmental advocates for their response.
The Australian Academy of Science has recently released its report, The Risk to Australia of a 3-degree Warmer World. It paints a grim picture for the type of environment that could characterise Australia if surface temperatures are allowed to increase by an average of 3 degrees relative to pre-industrial levels, which is the current trajectory for Australia unless action to reduce emissions is not accelerated at a global level.
Really, there's not that much good news in terms of Australia and climate change in terms of impacts and adaptation to those impacts. There is some good news in terms of how we may position ourselves in reducing our emissions. But when we look at the future in terms of things like droughts and coral bleaching, increased flood risk, it's not a really good picture for Australia.
That voice belongs to Mark Howden, one of the lead authors of the report.
Hi, Evan. I'm Mark Howden. I'm the director of the ANU Institute for Climate, Energy and Disaster Solutions.
I asked Mark to describe the consequences for Australia attached to a 3-degree warmer planet.
The report does paint a picture which is pretty grim for Australia. The sorts of things we expect to increase is, of course, things are going to get hotter, and particularly the heat waves are likely to increase in extent and also frequency. It's likely to get also more droughted. There's also likely at the same time to be more flood risk, so higher degree of flood risk, and things like coral bleaching are likely to occur more frequently. And overlaying all of this is a likely increase in climate extremes of different types.
That was Mark Howden from the Australian National University, one of the lead authors of the report. The Australian Conservation Foundation shares similar concerns. Here's their CEO, Kelly O'Shaughnessy, with her views on the report's findings.
Extremely concerned. I've always been very concerned about climate. Our climate is in trouble. And I suppose these reports aren't really new information. They do say how urgent the climate problem is. But I often use them as a moment to look back at where we were 5 years ago or 10 years ago and how much has changed. And we are seeing many of the solutions to climate change coming in to Australia and around the world right now. We do have many of the solutions. The uptake of them is way, way, way too slow, which is why we're seeing the types of climate damage in bushfires, floods and droughts we're seeing now. More of that will happen, unfortunately, because we've taken too long to address this climate problem. But the solutions are there, and we've got to stay 100% focused on rolling them out as fast as possible.
Kelly O'Shaughnessy, CEO of the Australian Conservation Foundation. Looking at potential solutions is Green Senator Janet Rice. She explored the report's focus on the need to encourage a significant uptick in the adoption of electric vehicles.
Hello, I'm Janet Rice. I'm the Green Senator for Victoria, and I'm the Green spokesperson for science, research and technology, and for forests, and for transport. So lots of climate-related impacts and issues associated in my work. At the moment, there's a cost barrier, and electric vehicles are still too expensive. And that's for a whole range of reasons. And one is that the cheaper models actually aren't being imported to Australia because we haven't got the market here. So it's a vicious circle. And so actually setting the targets and saying we want to be having a substantial proportion of our fleet being electric vehicles in itself would bring the cost down. But then offering incentives like other countries have done to make that upfront cost more, reducing the differential between internal combustion engines and electric vehicles. And so that's things like, you know, giving subsidies for stamp duty, for GST, for and just making it cheaper in the initial period of owning an electric vehicle to be running that electric vehicle.
The report makes a direct appeal for Australia to transition to a zero-emission economy in the next 10 to 20 years. Here's lead author Mark Howden on the thinking behind this call to action.
The purpose of going to net zero is to avoid the problematic futures of climate change that this report outlines. It's consistent with the Paris Agreement goals of keeping temperatures down to well below 2 degrees and, if possible, 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial. The way to do that is, firstly, by reducing those emissions that we produce. So it's pushing down on those emissions from electricity and transport. And secondly, it's by building up our ability to absorb those greenhouse gas emissions from the atmosphere. So it's pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. To do this really is, we know the technology. We have the technology to do a lot of this already. What we don't have is the action plans to put that technology into place.
Mark Howden there, lead author of the Australian Academy of Sciences report on the risk to Australia of a 3-degree warmer world report. The need for greater urgency comes through loud and clearly in the report if Australia is to play its role in avoiding a climate disaster. It's a prospect that drives the work of environmental organisations such as the Australian Conservation Foundation. Here's their CEO, Kelly O'Shaughnessy.
I think there's principles that have to shift within the decision makers first, so our politicians and our business leaders. We've got to stop talking about solving these crises as a problem. There is an opportunity in this country to solve climate change. It will create jobs. It'll create cheaper electricity. It'll create cheaper cars to drive around. This is all upside for us. But having debates about how much it will cost to act on climate change is the absolute wrong mindset to have. And unfortunately, that is where the debate is nationally, inside Parliament House and inside business boardrooms, all too often.
That was Kelly O'Shaughnessy, CEO of the Australian Conservation Foundation, speaking with The Wire's Evan Wallace.
The Wire, independent news and current affairs for the last 15 years and still going strong.
Well, that's about it for The Wire today. You can find all our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can listen to your own, or you can listen to our podcasts. Just search for The Wire Radio. The Wire is produced by 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. And you can hear us all around Australia on your radio, courtesy of the Community Radio Network, or online weekdays. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studio of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. It was produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Max Tillman. Do stay well, and thanks for your company.
light me to the safety of your home. Lead the way, lead the way, lead me down the hallway to your room. I'm alone, I'm alone, in some sicko's fishbowl dream. It's just me. So come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. Let's go. Let's go. Cause I'm bone tired, I'm bone tired. I'm just so tired of trying to work it out. I need to be rewired, my friends, rewired. Like a broke junkyard machine. Let me tell you, it's dark out on the scrap heap. Ah, you know what I mean. Light the way, light the way, light the way. Light the way with nothing but the moon.
It's time to introduce you to the wonderful,
the truly sublime
Twissia 107.3.